Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okay, all right.
Go to work.
Back to work. Back to work. Stop laughing.
So dumb.
When somebody says stop laughing, it makes me laugh.
Do you ever laugh at inappropriate times? I've gotten a case of the giggles at a wedding, and that was so embarrassing, and I couldn't stop laughing.
Tell me more.
I was young. I was like, I was just thinking, you know, have you ever had the giggles, and you just, it's the wrong time. Like, dad's yelling at you, and
yeah,
it's like, uh-oh, I'm only making this worse.
Or like when you're trying to do a radio show?
Yeah, or like...
kind of like that?
Right.
No, it has its place. Laughter is medicine for the soul, if you ask me. And this is like a pharmacy on stilts, if you ask me. See, we're doing it. We're doing it right now.
All right.
Let's go to Passaic, New Jersey, and talk to Joe. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning. Taco Center of the East Coast.
Indeed.
Just a quick diversion. Excuse me, sir?
Yes.
Okay. Of the East Coast, yeah. A lot of Mexicans up here. Anyway, just a quick diversion for asking my question. Is it possible that Joseph, since he always seems to be older than Mary, that he had children from another marriage and that they grew up and left, didn't come back before he married Mary?
That was a theory that was advanced by some of the church fathers, not too many of them actually, that St. Joseph was a widower and that children from that first marriage were those who were referred to as the brothers of the Lord. It's possible, but that's not the view that's held by maybe, seems to me, more influential theologians and church fathers. There actually is a very strong case to be made that St. Joseph also was a perpetual virgin and that he, when the Lord guided him to marry the Blessed Virgin Mary, that it was in some way made known to him that this was not going to involve marital intimacy in a physical sense. But that's, again, speculation. But I would say that there's a good strong case to be made that St. Joseph was not married before. I know it's kind of an easy fix. It's an easy explanation. It sort of makes things fit to say that he was a widower because then, okay, presto, now you've got kids who are called the brothers of the Lord and everything seems to fit together nicely. But I think that the alternative view is the more likely view, given what we know. So those are my thoughts on that, Joe. What was your actual question?
Then my quick question. Okay, is there such a thing as an attached spirit versus being possessed?
Yes. So the exorcist...
Sometimes when I go to church... Mm-hmm. Okay, let me preface one thing. First of all, thank the Relevant Radio. Thank you for you. Thank you to the Franciscan Friars of the Atonement that you sent me to. So everything's going pretty good. So then back to the question. I want to forget to thank you.
Great,
okay,
sure.
Attached spirits, go ahead.
Oh, okay, well, thanks for the thanks. All I was going to say was that some of the authors that I've read who are exorcists, they talk about this, and there's different terms, different levels of diabolical involvement. Infestation is a term that I've seen the exorcists use with regard to demonic activity in a particular place or in an object. So to use a biblical example, when our Lord was preaching, this would have been on the eastern shore of the Sea of Galilee, he was preaching and he was casting out demons from people. And in one case, many demons were being cast out and they asked him, you know, they pleaded with him, please send us into the bodies of these swine, because there was a herd of swine nearby. And I know you know the story. So he says, okay, fine. So they go into the bodies of the swine, and the swine freak out. They go over a cliff, and they drown. So what we can glean from this is that in some instances, it seems that these demons, they want to be inside something physical. They want to be in a place or a thing. And as I understand it, that's what the exorcists are referring to by diabolical infestation. Could be a house, it could be an object, it could be a person. So to your question, that would be, or could be at least, that could be something short of complete diabolical possession. It could be where the devil has attached itself, himself, or demons, really more properly speaking, attached themselves to a piece of furniture or an object or a room or a house, things like that. Does that get to the heart of
the
question?
The reason I ask is sometimes I go to church and I get the most terrible thoughts. And even sometimes when I go into communion, is the Satan able to influence your thoughts while you're receiving communion?
Here's what happens. So in this case, what's taking place is that the devil wants to stop you, if he possibly can, either from receiving the sacraments or to try to trip you up so that this receiving the sacrament is not going to be as spiritually beneficial to you as it would otherwise be. So although the devil does not have access to your secret thoughts, he's not permitted by God to know what your thoughts are. Nonetheless, he can see the images in your imagination. So your imagination is that capacity of your soul that converts, so to speak, the input that you get from your senses, what you see, what you touch, what you taste, etc. So our senses are constantly inputting information into our minds, and the imagination is the operation that converts those experiences that, from our senses into ideas, or better put, into images. So you can imagine, let's say that if there's some sinful thought, let's say against the sixth commandment, you can picture it in your mind. Or you may remember sins from your past, and you can picture it in your mind. Well, those things, St. Thomas says, the devil can see. It's like medical equipment that can read thermal imaging to see, you know, how is your body reacting when certain stimuli are applied, or what is happening in your brain matter when certain things are done, and how does your brain light up in one place or another. So that's all very sort of low level and primitive, but the demons, being fallen angels, they're still angels, so they are able to see those kinds of things. So it's one reason why it's so important to ask your guardian angel to help you purify your memory, to help him purge as much as possible those images. And then when you're going to Holy Communion, Joe, and this is something that's happened to me many times, it happens, quite frankly, more frequently than people realize, is that in those moments when you're trying to focus on the Lord, you're trying to prepare for Holy Communion, usually that's when, whammo, you know, up pops this, hey, remember this? These images or these ideas. So they're like playing cards. And he's trying to play a hand and see if he can trip you up. So the solution is, recognizing that this is how the devil operates, is to ask the Lord and ask your guardian angel in a particular way to purify your memory and to help delete as much as possible those images and things on the mental hard drive. And the angels will do that for you. It's something that they're there to do if we ask them to do that. Interesting and important question you're asking, Joe. Thank you. Let's go now to Carol in Wisconsin. Hello, Carol.
Hi there. Good morning. This question relates a little bit to something you talked about a little ways ago this morning with a woman about how to talk to somebody about abortion and some of the various situations. I saw something on Facebook by an acquaintance of mine, and whether this was a true story or not, I guess I don't really know, but it was about a woman married, so excited to be pregnant, having their first child, and then around the 17th or 18th week, found out something was the matter with the child. The baby was going to be born without a nasal bone, and the limbs were growing faster than the body, and just a variety of health issues. And she was apparently told by her doctor that continuing with this pregnancy would be bad for her body, so she had an abortion. not something she wanted, not something she ever thought she would do, according to this story, but this is what she had to do, I guess she felt. And the moral of that story is, how can anybody tell anybody else what to do with their body, since you don't know the situations that could come up? So I'm definitely, you know, opposed to abortion, but I'm not sure how to answer somebody that might have, whether it's a fake or real story or whatever, might have a situation like this where there are some medical reasons. So I'm wondering if you can help me with that.
Okay. I know a couple here in the Columbus area where I live who were told, when the wife was maybe 2-3 months along, they were told by the doctors, they were assured by the doctors that this unborn child she was carrying had multiple defects that would cause very likely the death of the child shortly after birth. And there was a list of things that were wrong with the baby. And so they were urging her to have an abortion. Now, these are Catholic folk, and so they never entertained that idea of having an abortion. But I remember the husband telling me all about this when it had just happened, and he said, they're pressuring us to have an abortion. We're not going to have an abortion, but they're telling us that this baby's going to be born deformed with all these problems. Well, they stood their ground. They didn't have the abortion, and the baby boy was born just fine. He was perfectly normal in every respect. In fact, he just got married last weekend. And he is a big, strapping, handsome young man. He's a sports star and all of the above. And this, I suspect, happens more frequently than people imagine, where the parents are told that your child has these different defects. No, he didn't marry my granddaughter, Cyrus. It was a different, this is a different wedding, but thanks for asking. So I would refer people to that, for example, that even though you had a bona fide medical doctor saying, this is what's going to happen, you better abort your baby, and look, it didn't happen. And imagine how that couple would have felt had they aborted the baby and then found out later, oh, this baby was perfectly fine. What a horrible, horrible thing to imagine. So I keep coming back to this, Carol, and maybe this will be beneficial in your next conversation. Just stick to this issue, and that is, no one has the right to take the life of an innocent person. Even if that innocent person happens to be taking up residence in your womb for 9 months, you don't have the right to kill an innocent human being. You just don't. So are situations in life sometimes very grim and difficult? Yes, that's life. And it's unfortunate, and we wish it weren't that way, but sometimes it is. Take rape as an example. So the thing to emphasize, it seems to me, is that sometimes we have to suffer for the benefit of another person. We don't seek the suffering, but sometimes we do, because that's the right thing to do. And it's the wrong thing to kill that person because he or she is inconvenient in some way. And then the last thing I'll mention is this issue of, well, what about rape or incest? Well, let's think about that for a minute. Rape is a heinous and reprehensible crime against a woman. It could be perpetrated against men too, but let's not talk about that. Men can't get pregnant. But in the case of women, when a woman is raped, it's a terrible, violent crime that victimizes her and uses violence against her and dehumanizes her, treating her as an object. Well, if a baby is conceived as a result of that and the woman has an abortion, it simply completes the cycle of violence. It simply extends in a horrible way what the rapist did in the first place, which is to now victimize yet another innocent person who has a right to be free from violence, and yet violence is visited upon that innocent human being so as to kill him or her, and the same thing happens all over again. So it's another innocent victim, in this case, who loses his or her life. Violence is perpetrated to dehumanize this person and to use the person as an object, in this case, an object to be rid of. So if we can decry, and we should, the evil and horror of rape, we should, on the same grounds, decry the evil and the horror of killing the child who was conceived as a result of rape. So when the mother chooses life for this child who was conceived in rape, she's actually breaking the cycle of violence. She's stopping the syndrome of violence. And it's important for people to understand that because it helps to undercut this superficial, facile notion that it's somehow good or better to have an abortion in the case of a child who's conceived in rape, or incest for that matter. It's the same thing, but two different scenarios. I'll leave it at that, Carol. Any mm-hmm. follow-up that you want to give?
No, I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome. Thank you. I appreciate your phone call. 888-914-9149. How about Jorge now in Fresno? Good morning, Jorge.
Hey, good morning, Patrick. How are you?
I
have to confess, I have two quick questions I forgot to tell your call screener about.
Okay, hit me, yeah.
So the first one relates to relics. If we have a first-class relic, a bone fragment of our parish saint, Saint Catherine of Siena.
Okay.
If we have her bone fragment, does that mean that she is present there?
No. No, she's in heaven, and the soul of any saint is in heaven. So you may have a fragment of the bone or a lock of hair or something like that. That's, you know, for as far as canonized saints are concerned, that's totally fine. So it's a memorial of her, but she's not present. So if you had this relic in your home, for example, it doesn't mean that St. Catherine of Siena is present in your home.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. And so what was your second question, Jorge?
Second question is, can I pray for somebody that has passed away already in the past? Can I pray for their in the hope that they converted in the moment of their death, or is that too late because they've already been judged?
Well, no, it's not too late. We have to understand two things. The answer to your question is yes, you certainly can, and the church encourages you to pray for the souls of those who have died. And the point to keep in mind is that because God is outside of time and space, he's not limited by those things the way you and I are. So your limitation is that you're now in the future when compared to when that person died, let's say 10 years ago. But God is outside of all that. So when you pray now, it's entirely possible. I would argue it's you know, it happens that God can apply your prayers to the person during his life as a way to help him maybe to die in the state of grace as opposed to dying in the state of mortal sin before he died. Now, we have to keep in mind that you can't change the outcome once somebody has died and been judged. So in this case, if somebody dies in the state of mortal sin and goes to hell, your prayers now don't change that. But your prayers now could easily have been applied by the Lord to him before he died so that he would die in a state of grace. Important distinction. Yeah.
Perfect. Excellent.
Well, I think so too. Yeah, thank you, Jorge. And that's a great time for us to take a break. We will come back with more. We have about 36, 37 minutes to go, a little bit more maybe. 888-914-9149 is my number. If you call now, very good chance that I'll get you on the air, so call now. I'll be right back. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Let me ask you, can the Catholic Church have a future if we Catholics don't understand our past? Experience history the way it should be taught in a free online class from Christendom College. Just go to principlesclasses.com.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Hope over fear. Just remember, the world can get crazy, that's for sure. But you have hope in the Lord, and there's no reason to be fearful. Don't be fearful. Trust in God. I like the way it says this in 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 7, "For God gave us a spirit not of fear, but of power and love and self-control." In 1 John 4, verse 18, "There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear. For fear has to do with punishment. Whoever fears has not been perfected in love." So coupling those statements with things that Jesus himself said about, no, don't worry. Don't worry. You know, the day has plenty of worry for its own sake. Just don't worry about what's going to happen. Trust in God and everything's going to be okay. Back to the phones. Let's go to Ralph in Scottsdale, California or Scottsdale, Arizona. Welcome, Ralph.
No, I'm in Chowchilla, California.
Chowchilla. Hello? Interesting. It says Scottsdale. Yeah. But welcome, Ralph.
Well, maybe I didn't articulate correctly, but Patrick, I don't want to belabor this thing about Mary, but I do have a few more questions in regards to that. I think you mentioned that the Protestants don't have the truth in regard to her having other babies. I was wondering how do we validate that as Catholics? And then the second question to follow that with is really, what does it matter if she had children after Jesus?
Well, what matters,
questions.
Yeah, I guess what matters is it true? And so truth matters, obviously. So if it's a revealed truth that Mary did not have other children, it matters for that reason alone. That's one thing. The other thing is that it would get to the question of, would it be fitting and appropriate for Mary, the virginal mother of the Savior, to have other children and to have sexual relations? Not that there's a problem with sexual relations in marriage. There's certainly nothing problematic about that. That's ordained by God, and that's beautiful and good in marriage. But it would be unnecessary, and I think the case could be made that it would be unfitting for her exalted status as the mother of Jesus. Now, there are other theological and even biblical things that one could say, but at the very least, that's why it would be important. Furthermore, this is a dogmatically defined dogma of the faith. So we would have to also say, well, if it's a dogmatically defined dogma of the faith and it's wrong, well, then everything is called into question. Everything that the church has ever taught, and certainly dogmatically, would be subject to doubt. You know, so if the church can be wrong about something like that, what else is the church wrong about? And if the church is wrong about anything, then the church can't be trusted. So there are a lot of interlocking pieces here that we have to consider. But you ask, how is it that we can know that Mary did not have other children besides Jesus? Or how can we make this truth claim? How do we establish it? Or how do we know that if somebody says that Mary had other children besides Jesus, how can we know that that's not true? I think that was your question, right? That was the first part of your question?
Right, right. Okay. In other words, how do we arrive at the truth and they don't?
Yeah, well, the way to do that is, you might call it this way, to triangulate using the biblical evidence. So that is the objective data that is transmitted to us in black and white, in writing. We also have recourse to apostolic tradition, which is, among other things, is the church's lived understanding of the meaning of Scripture. So we all know that Scripture says things, but it's important to know, what does it mean by what it says? So when Jesus says, "This is my body and this is my blood," what did he mean by that? He meant something by it, so we have to know, what does he mean by it? So if we only have recourse to the written word, that gives way to many different opinions. What I think this means, what you think this means. Now, opinions are great, but they don't decide the issue, because ultimately God intended something specific by what we read in Scripture. So the problem, one of the problems within the Protestant world, is the Bible becomes a Rubik's Cube. It's every man for himself. And they'll insist, no, we're translating it, we're interpreting it rather correctly, and this is how it should be interpreted, and sound principles of exegesis, et cetera, et cetera. All that is just another way of saying, this is what I think it means. And if a different person says, well, I don't think it means that, I think it means this, then you've got a difference of opinion. And whose opinion is right and whose opinion carries more weight? Some might say, well, I have a higher degree than you do, so therefore my opinion carries more weight. Or I know the biblical language and you don't, therefore my opinion carries more. That's just begging the question. It's a logical fallacy, and it's pure subjectivism. And that's no way for us to know the truth. So the second mode of transmission of the gospel, which St. Paul talks about in 2 Thessalonians 2:15, where he says to stand firm and hold fast to the traditions you receive from us, either by an oral statement or by a letter of ours. So there he's speaking about the gospel as it's transmitted as a single thing, tradition as such, and it's transmitted both in oral form, which we Catholics refer to as apostolic tradition. It's also it's transmitted in written form. And there the Bible tells us to hold fast to both. It's actually one of those passages that explicitly says don't go by the Bible alone. So what I'm driving at, Ralph, is how can we know whether or not our understanding of the Bible is correct, or is the Protestant understanding correct, is to bring alongside the written word. What does the apostolic tradition say? What has the church always taught on this issue? What did the earliest Christians believe on this issue? This is where patristics, the study of the church fathers, becomes so important. And that's how we can say with certitude, we believe in the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. And look, in the earliest centuries of the church, they did too. So what we're seeing here is a corroboration, not because, oh, whew, okay, great, they thought the same thing we do today. The reason is because the early church was the Catholic Church, the church you read about in the writings of the church fathers, the church you read about in the book of Acts in the New Testament. That was the Catholic Church, capital C. It was certainly not Protestantism, certainly not Mormonism or Jehovah's Witnesses or any of the other options out there. It was the Catholic Church in its seed form. So it didn't look like the Catholic Church looks today, but that's to be expected. Jesus said that the kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed, very small, very insignificant. It doesn't look like the big, nearly tree-sized plant that it becomes, but it's the same thing. It's the same entity. So in a short way of trying to explain it, this is how we can determine with accuracy whether or not what the church teaches today is in fact what was taught by Christ and by the apostles and what was believed in the early church. And one final thought, Ralph, and this is one reason why when people, when Protestants especially, begin to study the early church fathers, very, very, very often they become Catholic, because they realize that the early church was Catholic. And so this whole notion of a reformation being needed to kind of like reassert the truths that were lost and all of that gets blown away, because none of it's true in any case. And so this is why I would always recommend for people who are wondering about the Catholic Church, read the early church fathers. Read what they said. Read what they said about Mary and the Eucharist and sacraments and purgatory and the Mass and all these things. And you'll see them in sometimes in seminal form, but you'll see them in the early church. And the only way to argue against that would be to say that there was some kind of total apostasy that intervened between the time of Jesus and the end of the time of the apostles. And that, of course, would fly in the face of what Jesus said. He says, I will not leave you orphans. On this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. Behold, I'm with you always. The Holy Spirit will guide you into all truth, and so many other promises that he made. So those are some thoughts to consider, Ralph. Thank you. Let's go now to Sylvia in Katy, Texas. Good morning, Sylvia.
Hi, Patrick. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question. Thank you. Yeah, I have a question about, I guess, women's roles in modern society and context, I guess, within marriage. So it's pretty straightforward, you know, like the roles of women, like wife and mother. But say that woman has a career that she's taken a long time to procure. My question is, can a working wife, can a marriage be sustained if the wife is working outside the home in like the long term?
I certainly believe it can be. Each marriage, of course, is going to be unique and different circumstances will apply. It seems that motherhood is very likely and very often what results from marriage. And therefore, there's a real question to be asked. if it took her a long time and a lot of study, let's say multiple degrees in college, et cetera, to achieve her profession, you know, whatever it may be. Well, I mean, that's important, and that's an investment in her time and who she is as a person. So we don't want to devalue that. But then again, there's the question of if babies start coming along, as they usually do, which is the higher good? Is the higher good to maintain the profession and, let's say, choose not to have children, or to maintain the profession and have someone else raise your child, effectively speaking, daycare, etc.? Or would it be better to postpone continuing the profession in favor of being home with the children and taking care of them and making sure that they have the very best upbringing possible and not in the care of a third person if it's possible to avoid that? So those are the kinds of questions that the woman and her husband would have to evaluate and to see what is the right thing to do. So I can see where in some instances that the mother might say, well, I'm a physician and I'm curing cancer, or I'm doing something that's extremely urgent right now, that could be a reason for them to maybe practice NFP for a time and space out children so that it would be easier for her to do this. I know that some employers will permit even the mother to bring a baby and have a baby in a little playpen. It's not common, but it's not unheard of. Now, in the post-COVID world that we live in, it's not at all uncommon for people to do their work but do it from home. So it may be that she can pursue this vocation or this profession, rather, and earning income for the family and fulfill all of her study and all that, and at the same time do it from home or a hybrid situation. So my sense is that this is the kind of question that the husband and the wife should ponder carefully and consider all the options. But more often than not, if I had to sort of lean to one side or the other, I'm always going to be going to the default position that it's always preferable for the children if their mother is there with them. If their mother is there to nurture them and raise them and teach them to pray and teach them to get along and all those things, that's always going to be the best case scenario. It's not always possible. And in some cases, you know, it's nobody's fault. It's just how it is. But if it's possible to achieve that paradigm, I think that's the preferable way to go. Does that make sense?
Yes, that does. I guess you kind of answered a secondary or a follow-up question, which was, you know, what if the husband in that situation really does lean more towards, having the wife stay at home, but on her end, she is doing something relatively important with her job as well, and finds personal, sanity maybe in that, mm-hmm. and also a lot of value as well. How do you balance that, I guess, is my question.
Yeah, that's the tricky part, because that's a balancing act that has to be achieved between the husband and the wife. So on the one hand, he can't dictate terms to her. He can't say, listen, this is how it's going to be. He has to respect her. And he has to take into account her desires as a person, because she has her own life to live and she has her own way of trying to pursue holiness. But at the same time, she too can't dictate terms to him and say, this is how it's going to be. I'm going to do this. The tricky part is for the couple to recognize that they have to achieve their decision together. And it sometimes happens that they're at loggerheads and they just don't agree. So that's sometimes where, you know, that you have to make a decision. What are we going to do one way or the other? And so I would advocate that the husband should always respect his wife, recognize her autonomy and her own desires, etc., but that she too should be seeking to do what's best for the marriage, best for the family. So if they're both approaching it that way, then it seems like the likelihood of an impasse can be avoided. But if one or the other is insisting it's going to be this way, whether you like it or not, that's a real problem. You know, that's where a lot of division in marriage can arise. So I'm looking at the clock though, Sylvia, I've got to take a break. Thank you for the important question. I do appreciate that. I'm going to be right back. And don't forget, as Jesus said, in the world you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer, for I have overcome the world. So don't be anxious. Don't be fearful. Hope and encouragement. Hope and encouragement. Hope and encouragement. That's what we're all about here at Relevant Radio. Truth over fear. Don't be fearful. Stand in the truth and everything's going to be okay. I'll be right back. Relevant Radio runs on horsepower. Your horsepower. Donate any vehicle and keep our stations running. Join in with hundreds of other listeners who have donated their used vehicles at relevantradio.com/car.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
Okay, we're back, 888-914-9149. Let's go to Ruben in Austin, Texas. Hi, Ruben.
Hello, Patrick. Listen, I have a question about the Apostles' Creed. That yes. one line where it says that he descended into hell, and on the third day he rose again.
Yeah.
Why did it say he rose again from the dead?
Yeah, it's a figure of speech that if you look at it from one direction, it kind of looks like, does that mean that he rose twice? And the answer is no, it doesn't. So if I said that I fell down and got up again, it doesn't mean I got up twice. It just means that after I fell down, I got back up. That's how we say it in English. I got up again, or I got back up. So what it's referring to is that Jesus was alive, then he died, then he was alive again. So he rose again is referring to, obviously, the resurrection. It's not saying that he rose twice. It's like saying, fell down, I got up again. That's what it means.
Okay, I pondered and I thought about this and thought about it and just could not figure out why they always said he rose up again. But yes, well, that makes sense.
Good, I'm glad. This is actually one of those questions that pops up quite a lot. You know, it's something that other people have wondered about as well. So glad you gave me a chance to talk about it again. Thank you. How about Peter in Woodland, California? Good morning, Peter.
Good morning. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can, yeah.
Okay, perfect. So I have a question about abortion. Whenever I talk to people, like non-Catholics, a lot of times they'll say, like they balk at the idea life at conception. They'll say, well, to me, I feel like it starts at the heartbeat or like 3 months, or they'll make up a number. And I just wonder, what's the best thing for me to say to them when I tell them that I believe in life from conception and natural death? How do I argue for life at conception? You know, they say it's just the egg and the sperm, that's not a life, but then you smush them together and it's a life. Like, how can I make that make sense to them?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, maybe you could start by asking, well, what is it? You know, if it's not alive, what is that? And how is it that it's growing? If it's not alive, how can it grow? I mean, a corpse doesn't grow. A corpse, a dead body, to use that example, doesn't grow. It doesn't continue. An inanimate object like a rock doesn't grow. It just sits there. So clearly you're looking at something in the womb that is growing. So how can it not be alive? That'd be the first question I'd ask. And then the person might say, well, okay, it's alive, but it's not human. Okay, well then what is it? What is that thing? It's not the mother, because it has a different DNA, has a different genome. It has a separate systems that are growing. I mean, the different systems even prior to a heartbeat, circulatory system, etc. So if it's alive, we've already established that it's alive. Well, what is it? It's a living what? It can't be a tumor. It can't be like an organ in the mother, because those are all part of the mother, and that would share her same DNA and the same blood type and all that. This is something different. What is that? And the reason I say this, Peter, is so that you can help break down this only, it's a superficially plausible thing that they're saying, but it breaks down very quickly when you start asking questions like that. And ultimately, they're going to have to say, well, either I don't know what it is, which is stupid because they do know what it is, they just don't want to admit it, or they may say, well, it's human. And then they'd have to say, well, it's not fully human, or it's not, you know, like a real human being. And then you could say, well, then at what point does it become a real human being? And why is it not fully human then? So by asking questions like this, you can just break down the argument, and you'll see how these illogical premises will begin to come to the surface. And often that's a better approach than trying to lecture somebody. Just ask those kinds of questions. Peter, what do you think?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. That's a great answer, and that totally answers my question. Thank you. I appreciate your time.
You're most welcome. Great talking to you. Thank you. How about William now? Let's go to William in Lexington, Kentucky. Good morning, William.
Hey, good morning, Patrick. I have a question about the Divine Mercy Chaplet. And obviously, Jesus' message to St. Faustina is that if it's said in the presence of the dying, that he will pour his graces out for the most hardened of sinners. Mm-hmm. So if we believe that, is it also on the part of the hardened sinner themselves that they have to be truly contrite and, you know, meet Jesus in a sense? And the other part of that question is, how do we reconcile that with the first letter of John, chapter 5, verse 16, where it's pretty clear what the church's teaching is when it comes to mortal and venial sin, and why apparently we're not supposed to pray for those in mortal sin, unless I've misunderstood that passage.
Okay, we'll come back to that passage in a moment. So first of all, the praying of the Divine Mercy Chaplet is, as I understand it, it is a way for these special graces that God wants to give this person to be applied so that they, if they're not contrite, so that they will become contrite. So in other words, God is not going to save somebody if the person is not contrite, but the graces that God gives the person can help him become contrite. So that's how I understand the importance of praying the chaplet in the presence of someone who is dying. Now, as far as the different sins that St. John talks about in 1 John 5, he says there's all wrongdoing is sin, but there are some sins that are not mortal or deadly. And then he goes on to say, I do not say that you should pray about this. That is an enigmatic statement, to be sure. And so I don't want to insist that this necessarily is the way to answer that. But it seems to me that this is the best way that I know of to answer that, where he says, all wrongdoing is sin, but there is sin which is not mortal. We know that anyone born of God does not sin. I'm in the wrong spot. If anyone sees his brother committing what is not a mortal sin, he will ask and God will give him life. For those whose sin is not mortal, there is sin which is mortal. I do not say that one is to pray for that. The reason I think this is enigmatic is because obviously we do pray for sinners. We do pray that they would be saved. And we know this because Jesus himself did this. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they're doing. And he was experiencing the effects of their mortal sin of putting him to death. So I don't know exactly what St. John intended in a maybe a more nuanced way, but I think by way of elimination, we could eliminate the possibility that he meant in some literal way that we should never pray for anyone who is in the state of serious sin. We'd all be doomed in that case. And using Jesus as our example of praying for people who are in the state of mortal sin, I think we could eliminate that as a way to interpret this passage. And I hope that's helpful. Thank you. We'll go now to Noah in Southgate, California. Hello, Noah.
Hey, Patrick Madrid. Thank you for everything you do and everybody in the Reveland Radio. Yeah, my question was, when the Bible says not even the gates of hell will prevail, but it kind of feels like it is. So how can we understand that? But in a way, when I was listening to the show, I was thinking about it. I mean, I guess it's not prevailed because there's always some good priests still left in the church and stuff like that. So I quite understand it now. But I have another question, if I may.
I don't know if we'll have time for a second one, but let me take a run at this one, Noah. Good question. I think you're referring to what Jesus says in Matthew chapter 16, verse 18, where he says, upon this rock I will build my church and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. I think the meaning of that passage is not that the church is like a fortress and it will defend itself from hell, I mean, to some extent, that's true, I guess. But it seems to me more likely that what Jesus is saying is that hell cannot withstand the onslaught of the church. The grace and truth of Jesus is going to break through the gates of hell, that the gates of hell will not prevail, meaning that Jesus and his gospel and grace and truth are coming to rescue those who are enslaved behind the gates of hell, in this life, that is, and that hell is not strong enough to stop Jesus from going in there and rescuing those who would be saved. So I don't think the gates there are offensive weapons. I think it's referring to hell. We're going to gate crash hell, or the church is gate crashing hell, might be a better way to look at it. So in short order, I hope that's helpful to you. No, I appreciate that. Let's go now to Mike in Atlanta. Good morning, Mike.
Hey, good morning. I recently read Monsignor Rossetti's Diaries of an American Exorcist, and it really resonated with me because it helped me understand that a lot of the evil that we are experiencing now and the lunacy is Satan-inspired. I'm a longtime Catholic, and I just don't hear much about Satan in my church in Atlanta or on the airwaves, and I'd like to know why. What are we afraid of in talking about Satan and his role in the world today?
Well, have you asked that question of your parish priest?
I have not. I have actually recently spoken to him on several occasions on measures that we should be taking in light of the vandalism that is taking many of our churches, including my sister's in Princeton Junction, New Jersey, yesterday. And he seems to take a very moderate, low-key position, but had not addressed the issue of Satan with him directly. No, sir.
Okay. Well, I mean, I understand your question, but I'm not sure why you're asking me this question. If your complaint is that your local parish doesn't talk about the devil enough, why not ask them that question? I mean, how can I answer that question for them? Unless you're asking it rhetorically. I mean, unless you're saying, how come nobody anywhere ever talks about the devil? But that's not what I understood you to be saying, unless I misunderstood you.
No. No, I think I hear you periodically insert the diabolical nature of Satan, but I was unaware myself of how prevalent Satan's influence is in the world as a lifetime Catholic. And it's just not my recent church. I've been, you know, I've lived around the country for 60 years.
Okay.
And it just doesn't seem to me that the role of Satan in the church in general, and maybe I've been sheltered, is not something we talk a whole lot about.
I wouldn't disagree with that. I think by and large is probably true. Maybe in the more traditional parishes, you're going to hear more of those things, and those that are less traditional and more happy clappy, you're going to hear less of that. It seems like that phenomenon will vary depending upon parish. So in the parishes where, you know, they're just not really all that convinced about things like the reality of sin and hell, and it seems like there you're not likely to hear about it for that reason. But in parishes where it's taken seriously and the world, the flesh, and the devil are understood to be the threats that they really are, well, then I think you're likely to hear more about it. But, I mean, it would be a place-to-place kind of thing, it seems to me, Mike.
All right. Well, I'll keep searching for a parish in which I think they put Satan, pay much more attention to him and his diabolical ways than I've been exposed to in my last 60 years. So thank you so very much. And by the way, I recommend seeing Monsignor Stephen Rossetti's book, The Diary of an American Exorcist. I thought it was brilliant.
Okay. Thanks for the tip. I appreciate that. Yeah, my only rejoinder to that would be I personally would rather be in a parish where the focus is on Jesus and him and his gospel and the truth and all that, with a reminder, of course, that the devil is real. And as it says in 1 Peter 3:15, that he's like a roaring lion prowling around looking for someone to devour. That's part of the gospel, certainly. But I would be nervous about going to a parish where it's all about Satan. I mean, then it would seem to be way out of balance. The focus should be on Christ with a recognition of the work of the evil one, but not an obsession or an imbalanced focus on the devil. That would be my one word of caution, if I can give you that. Thank you. Let's go to Betty now in Daly City, California. Hi, Betty.
Hi, Patrick. I need your help with a referral or a recommendation for a counselor in my area. It's for my 22-year-old niece, and she's going through anxiety and depression. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering if you can offer some guidance for someone or some team in my area.
I can. What I would recommend is that you go to the Archdiocese of San Francisco website and drill down to their family services department, and they will have referrals available to you. You could call them on the phone or send an email, but that would be a ready place of referrals that they would know, you know, these are good people. So whether it's family life or marriage therapy, things like that, that'd be the easiest and quickest way to get somebody in your area. Thanks, Betty. Let's go to Hector now in Riverside. Good morning, Hector.
Good morning, Patrick. I know we have a few minutes. I'll be quick. My question is this. Okay, so a Catholic grandmother, if she rents her house to her Catholic granddaughter, and grandma knows that the Catholic granddaughter is going to move in with the boyfriend, is the grandmother committing mortal sin?
Well, it's hard to know whether she's committing a mortal sin, but I think it would be sinful to knowingly facilitate that. So if she knows that her granddaughter is going to shack up with her boyfriend, and of course, it's a matter of course that mortal sins would be committed, then she's participating in that in the sense that she's facilitating it. So if I were her, obviously I would say, you know, I'll rent this to you, but you, one of the rules is you can't have your boyfriend living with you. And if the rule gets broken, then so does the rent agreement. Interesting question, Hector. Thank you. Well, until tomorrow, I'll be praying for you. Please do pray for me. And I will see you tomorrow. Same Pat time, same Pat channel. God bless you.